Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
This is Increment Vice. The podcast that explores Paul Thomas Anderson's inherent vice one scene at a time with your host, Travis Woods. Was it possible that at every gathering, concert, peace rally, love-in, be-in, and freak-in, here, up north, back east, wherever, some dark crews had been busy all along, reclaiming the music, the resistance to power, the sexual desire from epic to everyday, all they could sweep up for the ancient forces of greed and fear? That's a question Doc's mind with the munchies chews on in Inherent Vice, both the book and the film. Gee, ultimately thinks. I don't know. Well, today's guest certainly thinks so, as he walks us through the lattice of beastly beneficiaries to the betrayal of a generation, a movement, a decade, a country, COINTELPRO informants, conspiranoid CIA ops, mismanaged and malevolent FBI agents, rogue LAPD officers, and that strange sick fuck Charlie Manson himself, and just how easily they can swing you to their side with a simple conversation in a room a lot like the one Doc finds himself in today.
Stylistically, Paul Thomas Anderson's career is one divided by a distinct schism. Those hoping the valley-obsessed director would return to the cocaine-fueled dollies, smash cuts, and whip pans of his early pictures are going to be sorely disappointed, because Inherent Vice is at one with his later films, possessing the distancing austerity of There Will Be Blood and The Master. But the brash youngster who gave us a Scorsesean Boogie Nights and Magnolia meets his Kubrickian elder self in his middle, as both aesthetic halves are unified by his distinct molding of character. The easy comparison to make here would be the colorful nitwits and stoned would-be detectives who populate the cartoonish LA of the Coen brothers' The Big Lebowski. However, the truth is that PTA is reaching back to his roots and attempting to channel his mentor, Altman, particularly the director's work with Elliot Gould, along with the dope-loving boorishness of something akin to Cheech and Chong's next movie. The biggest challenge to speaking the language of Inherent Vice is when the cinematic stoicism and rampant buffoonery collide head-on, resulting in a dissonant tonal juxtaposition. It's the filmic equivalent of smoking a joint with your very wise family member, who just happens to be graced with harpist Joanna Newsom's playful chirp, as she paints a vivid portrait of a paranoid, perplexing time in which you probably never existed. That is today's guest on the smog-fogged, melancholic majesty of PTA's adaptation of Inherent Vice. He's a writer whose work spreads across such publications as Rebeller, Fangoria, Birth Movies Death, and The Dark Moon Digest, as well as his myriad of invaluable capsule reviews that can be found on Letterboxd, for films that range from premier prestige pictures to magnetic tape-warping megatonic obscuro schlock. He's someone whose writing makes me interested and engaged in every fucking film he writes about, which is why he's my guest today on what is maybe the one scene I sort of kind of have difficulty connecting with in all of Inherent Vice. And so, Jacob Knight, how the hell are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. That's, you know, you have to stop doing these intros. They're great, but it makes me feel like I have something to live up to. and I haven't lived up to anybody's expectations my whole life, and I'm not going to start now, so apologies beforehand.
Well, you will fit right in here with me, a grown-ass man with a Inherent Vice podcast.
So yeah, right?
We belong together.
So, yeah,
Jacob,
we do.
We belong together, all right? You're here. You're among friends.
That works.
And plus, I gotta butter you up a little bit. You're nice enough to come on and talk about this 6-year-old movie with me. I have to make you feel special, and you are special. You're special to me, damn it.
Oh, thank you. I've got to be special to somebody because my cat wouldn't take a nap with me earlier tonight.
Oh, it hurts my heart.
Yeah.
I appreciate you coming on today because, as I said, your writing is something I intensely, intensely enjoy. The way you can concisely dig into why a movie matters, why a movie works, why a movie is important. Whether it's a prestige picture or it's, you know, something that you can only find on a battered VHS tape in the back of a video store, you always make me interested in what you have to say. And this is kind of a movie, this is kind of a scene in which I have a hard time focusing, weirdly enough. I know I love this movie. I love this movie so much more than I love just about every other movie. But this has always been a scene that I have a little bit of difficulty getting my arms around.
And which is interesting because I find it to be one of the scenes that actually unlocks the movie for me to a degree. Because I'm going to be honest. When you asked me to be on the show, I decided to approach this guest appearance as with a certain type of methodology. Is that I listened to every episode of Increment Vice, and then I wanted to basically get your perspective on the movie and your guest's perspective on the movie. And then I wanted to revisit the film immediately after and see if that tainted or changed at all the way that I viewed it. And what I found is that I disagree to a degree with your take on it. And some of your get not in a negative way. It's just I think there's a divergence in perspective that we kind of have in that you very much connect with the movie on an emotional level where I still find it to be an intensely cerebral exercise a lot of the time. And I know that, you know, you very much have gone and said time and again on your show about how, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson basically made a movie about like the idea of like loss and like, what can you live without? And how does this relationship between Doc and Shasta Fey and their kind of, let's say, dissolution, like, how does that represent the loss of a decade to like pension? But like, PTA is very much more interested in, let's say, the humanistic side of that. Mm-hmm. And I agree with that to a degree, but I also think the movie's a very, very political film. And that's the side that I find myself, every time I watch it, kind of diving into, while never forgetting the fact that you are dealing with Paul Thomas Anderson, and he's a guy who I think every movie that he's ever made can be summed up with his very glib Valley Boy retort of it's just about love, baby.
It's about love, baby.
Yeah. And I think that shines through in this movie as well. But I also think that he made two movies at the same time and maybe not intentionally, if that makes sense.
I think I get what you're saying. I will say, how dare you come on this show and challenge me? I don't go to where you live and tell you that you're wrong about some of your favorite films. I just went off. I complimented you. I complimented how insightful you were. and then you come here to my home where I live. No, that's great. This will be a fun conversation then, because I really, nerd that I am for this film, I really do love hearing what everyone else thinks about it, especially if they have a differing opinion or a divergent opinion, because I can be very myopic in my obsession with this film now that I've decided what it is to me. And so it's really, really exciting to hear what someone else thinks that's a little bit different. And one thing that you wrote in your original review of the film for Synapse back in the day, you mentioned something. You wrote, the biggest challenge to speaking the language of Inherent Vice is when the Cinemax stoicism and rampant buffoonery collide head on. And that to me is this scene very much so. I want to loop. We haven't watched the film, the sequence yet, and I want to loop deeper into it after we do that. But I do think that maybe one of the reasons I have a hard time with this sequence is that it feels like it's striving for the broadly comic, but it is done in that very kind of dour, minimalist, almost, you know, in the last episode we kind of compared PTA's filmography to the discography of Radiohead. This is him very much in his King of Limbs phase, but trying to do what is a very comic scene. And something about that tonal juxtaposition, it always just kind of throws me in this scene a little bit. It always kind of, I never quite know where I'm at in it, and never have the ability to really get my arms around it.
Sure. And plus it doesn't help when Timothy Simons is on screen, because all I ever see is Jonah from Veep. So when his big lurch looking ass shows up as a federal agent, I'm like, what is this guy doing here? Because I never find him anything less than utterly hilarious. But I think what's also, and not to jump too far ahead about the scene too, is that what I think is cool about it is that it serves a couple different purposes, is that it clarifies a particular theme that I really connect to in the movie, a political theme, let's say. But also, I think it's really great because it's one of these scenes that kind of shows you how Doc can take control of a situation. And how competent he can be, which, you know, it's very easy to get lured into the idea of Doc Sportello as being kind of this bumbling goofball for a lot of the movie. But like, he's way sharper than he lets on for a solid chunk of the movie. And he, in a strange way, is always kind of a few steps ahead of some of the people that he's talking to, while also being simultaneously lost in, as you even put it, the kind of fog and the haze of both weed and just the mystery in general.
You know what? You're doing it already. I like the scene more already. And it's not that I disliked it. It was just, this has always just been the moment where I don't connect emotionally to the film, but already I'm digging it more just hearing you say that. And before we dig into the scene proper, I do want to say, for those of you who are listening, that yes, Jacob and I can hear that annoying chime that keeps coming up every couple of minutes. In the studio that I am in today, someone has snuck a phone in and left it. And in a very kind of Inherent Vicean way, it's just going to continue to go off and drive me slowly fucking mad. And so everyone's going to have fun listening to that.
Well, you know what? It had stopped there for a few minutes, and then you brought it up. Like,
yeah, but it's going to keep happening.
You think so? I'm just hoping that it goes away at some point. Like, whoever's sexting at the moment, just, you know, maybe they're done. The boner is gone.
Well, that's what a lovely line, because this is an end of the era movie. The boner is gone. It's a fitting. Yes. It's a fitting epitaph for this episode already. that said, you're one of the true believers. You've loved this film since its release, right?
I have, but I would be lying if I didn't say that my relationship to the movie didn't change over the last 6 years. because I still believe I saw it very early in 2014, right around the time that I believe it was receiving. I'd have to check the dates, but where it was receiving a general release in New York and LA, I believe.
Yeah, it was mid-December.
Yeah, because I saw it. I think I had to go back and check. I saw it on December 14th, 2014. But to me, saw it under conditions that were cool, but at the same time, not ideal to take in a movie that is as dense as Inherent Vice is, because I saw it at Butnumathon, where it was the fourth movie, I believe. And like, it was sandwiched in, like, we had just seen, it was the fourth movie of the day, but it was sandwiched in between like big premieres as well. Like we were one of the first, if not the first audience to see The Kingsman. That was introduced by Samuel L. Jackson. And then I believe immediately after Inherent Vice, we were, again, maybe the first, or not one of the first audiences to see The Interview with Seth Rogen there, right before all of that shit with The Interview happened, where like North Korea got mad at it, or my memory is very hazy of what the hell actually happened, because it also kind of felt like a publicity stunt to a degree. But like North Korea got mad at it, and then like the studio pulled it or something. So like, which I found incredibly hilarious, having seen the movie and all this shit was basically going on. And I'm like, I mean, this is a film in which Katy Perry, or like James Franco, sings Katy Perry with a North Korean dictator. How dangerous are we really going to label this film? Like, it's intensely silly. But back to Inherent Vice, like, as much as I loved it the first time, I instantly knew I had to see it again, just because watching this movie in any kind of marathon setting doesn't do it any kind of it doesn't a disservice, let's say, because this is the type of film, especially the first time that you watch it, that you should watch and then you should be able to chew on for a little bit mentally. And like, jumping straight from this into The Interview is like, just total whiplash, you know?
I can't even imagine what that has to be. I mean, I've seen this as part of like a double feature before. I've seen this doubled with The Long Goodbye. I've seen this doubled with...
And at least those complement each other, though.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen it with The Long Goodbye. I've seen it doubled with Demi's Model Shop. You know, films that kind of speak and have a conversation with one another.
Sure.
But Jesus Christ, that's a weird way to watch this movie, and to really to soak up and absorb its melancholy in between The Kingsman and The Interview. But hey, one thing you can say, Inherent Vice, a movie so good, even North Korea loves it.
Yeah, even, you know, North Korea didn't protest this movie.
No, they didn't want to go to war over Inherent Vice. Who could?
They were fine with it. But no, I mean, I think when I watched it, this week, it was the fourth or fifth time I've watched it. I want to say, you know what? I think we're at four now, because I saw it during that Butnumathon event. I didn't actually go back and see it in theaters during general release, which I feel kind of bad about now in hindsight. And then I believe I saw it on Blu-ray when it was originally released. And then you'll get a kick out of this, being the massive Inherent Vice geek that you are. I have a good buddy here in Austin who is basically like one of my cinema soulmates, we'll say. And Drafthouse was playing a 70 millimeter print of Inherent Vice downtown at the Ritz. And I went to him and I was like, oh, we should go, Inherent Vice. And he kind of looked at me and he was like, you know, that's the one Paul Thomas Anderson that I don't know if I like it. And I was like, really? That's interesting. And he was like, yeah, he's like, I don't think it's bad. It's like, he was just like, you know, I just didn't connect with it on any real level. And I'm like, well, I feel like this is the perfect time for you to check it out. Like, you get to go watch it in 70 and, like, just see if maybe, you know, we can finalize an opinion on it. And he's like, all right, let's do it. So we went and we watched it. And he had such a reversal of an opinion on the movie that he actually grew his beard out to look like Doc Sportello's mutton chops and then cut them into it and kept them that way for about the next year or so, to the point that his longtime partner looked at me at one point and she was like, hey man, is there any way that you can talk him into shaving? Because I fucking hate these mutton chops. And I was like, I can't tell him shit. And honestly, I think it's kind of hilarious.
So, bless his heart. He's going to have a bonus episode.
Yeah, like he really turned around on it, because I remember we walked out of the theater and he was like, you know what? That movie is great. And I'm like, I believe so, too.
You are fighting the good fight out there, one person at a time, turning them around. Good for you.
Well, I'm gonna be honest with you, man. Though even this week when I watched it again, and I threw something up on Twitter that kind of expresses this sentiment, is that it's strange. It's like every time I watch Inherent Vice, it's a great, great film that I just get sucked into and kind of let wash over me. But for whatever reason, and you probably have films like this in your life, especially when it comes to like great directors and stuff, is that you think about a movie within the context of a director's filmography and you go, oh, well, this is like middle of the pack. Yeah. Or maybe this is towards the bottom for me or whatever. And for whatever reason, I have that in my head about Inherent Vice as going into this viewing, is that for me, I was like, oh, this is like middle of the pack, maybe bottom PTA. But then I watch and I go, no, this might be like top tier, top three Paul Thomas Anderson, because it's definitely his headiest movie, no pun intended, but it's also his densest. But to the kind of the point that you were saying in your intro, to me, this might be for me his most Kubrickian film, at least from a visual standpoint, because of all of those like intensely slow dissolves, the way that scenes like bleed into each other, and the editing in this movie is just it's incredible, man. Like it really creates this tableau of both. It combines the head and the heart in a way that I don't think any of his other movies really ever achieved. And I was really, really taken with it this week again. And I came away from it going, nah, this might be his masterpiece. I'm not sure. Or at least one of his masterpieces.
Oh, I mean, you certainly know where I fall on that spectrum of the conversation. So I won't run you through it again. I will ask, you know, you are someone, as you've said, you've admired the film since its release, and you are a movie obsessive. So I know that you think about this shit the way I do, this silly stuff. You said that as you've come back to it about four times now, the reason it hooks you, it seems to change as you get older, right? Like the thing that hooked you the second time you saw it doesn't maybe be that it's not quite the thing that hooks you the fourth time. And it's because for me, it's a film that has this kind of emotional modulation that matches where I am in life at the time that I watch it. It never ceases to be the movie I saw it 6 years ago, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, 2 years ago. But it becomes a different film on top of that, too. With each subsequent viewing. And it seems like that happened to you again this time out.
Yes. I think it's worth noting that I was married when I saw it the first time. So revisiting it since, I had since gotten divorced after 8 years of marriage. So there is the element of examining it through that lens of like what happens to you as a person After the kind of dissolution of one of your, let's say, defining relationships in your life, and how do you view that? How do you look back on that? How do you kind of reconcile who you were as a person then and who are you as a person now? Which I think is kind of a key to understanding Doc as a character. It's one of the things that I really love about the movie, is that to me, it's a movie about self-realization at a certain point.
Sure.
And realizing maybe you perceived your own relationship in a way that it wasn't, which I think is great. Man, God bless whoever you have on this show that has to talk about. I think in the episode with Jimmy Hemphill said something similar, is that God bless whoever you have to talk to about that Shasta Faye sex scene and monologue, because it's such a phenomenal scene, and Catherine Waterston in that moment is like just operating on a whole other level, but at the same time, very let's say difficult scene from a kind of sexual politics angle, and also just an angle of analyzing Doc as a character. Because to me, it becomes a moment in which he realizes maybe something more about himself than anything else, and how he maybe perceived his relationship with Shasta Faye to a degree. There's that. That, you know, I did kind of evolve as a person from then. But also, I think the one thing about this movie that confounds a lot of people is that it speaks to a very particular moment, or at least a particular side of American politics, in a way that maybe as you get older and as you develop your own views, or at least you solidify your own views and your own kind of perception of both where we are now as a country and as a world politically, and as we kind of were then, like, you might interpret it slightly differently as you get older, because obviously we're always changing, or our views on the world are always evolving and everything. And like, again, I think that's a big part of what this movie is about. To me, Inherent Vice is very much about, and I hesitate to use this term because I believe it's become perverted to a degree, but I think it's a movie about wokeness, and becoming, having your eyes opened to a particular moment in history and viewing it maybe without rose-tinted glasses on.
Oh, no, completely. I completely agree with that. And it's interesting that you know, I'm always, as you said, you know, I'm always connecting this film to the more emotional aspects of it, I think. And I can see how this is going to be a good talk, because I think you go to the other end of the spectrum on that, as you said, to the more political implications of the film. But no, I totally agree. And that scene that you mentioned, the sex scene, which, Jesus, that's going to be a fun day to chit chat about that one. That scene to me is exactly as you said. It's as if Doc is having to look at someone clearly for the first time, and in looking at Shasta clearly for the first time, I think it kind of forces him also to look at himself a little bit more clearly, and recognize that this person is maybe, it's someone he loves, still loves, maybe not quite the person that he idealized, or that he built his idealization around. And what that has to say about himself as well, that, well, he would do that.
Well, that, and I also think that it speaks to how women in general were perceived maybe during the 60s and the free love movement as objects to a degree. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, there's a unity in that moment between Doc and Mickey Wolfman that he might not have realized, in that they both perceive Shasta Faye as something to be possessed instead of let's say, sharing an existence with, or seeing each other's perspective, or maybe empathizing with, because, you know, in that moment, and again, we're jumping way ahead in the film.
As someone who's listened to this show, you know that it happens every time.
Yes, it's an entire show made out of digressions, let's say, much like the movie. But, you know, in that moment, he's very much seeing that women may have been perceived as objects within, you know, kind of the free love movement. And Shasta Faye even challenges him at one point and basically says, well, is that what you want? Did you always want a Manson like girl who, you know, basically drops to your feet and does your every bidding, you know, sexually and otherwise? And it's something to really consider in that moment, is like, what did Manson and his control over his family, and particularly the women of his family, what did that represent on kind of a broader sociopolitical kind of scale, in terms of like what the free love movement was? Did the men in the free love movement actually see them as equals? Did they see them as women and people to be empathized with? Or did they simply just see them as another conquest, as another thing to have and to hold and to possess? And that's, I think that's really interesting to consider. And I think that's something that Doc in that moment considers and never had considered before.
Sure. And, you know, I think you're so right when you talk about the way women were treated, well, women are treated, but the way women were treated in especially in, you know, the more openly permissive free love movement, when you would have a guy like Wolfman taking advantage of that and being so possessive, and, you know, with his tirac of conquests, and how he would, you know, even farm his girls out, his women out, his girlfriends, his side flings out to his friends, if that's what he deigned to do for the day. And while Doc is certainly not that, I do think that there is perhaps a moment in that scene where he does see a little bit of a Venn diagram overlap in his melding his desire for Shasta a little closer to Wolfman's, in that I do think that he has built up a version of Shasta that might not exist, that might not be real, this idealized vision of her. And I think it's easy for anyone to do that. And then you don't see it as being possessive, and you don't see it as being almost like a conquest, but there is that, I think, maybe that unspoken part of you that's just like, just be the person that I see in my head. Just be that person. Not realizing how possessive that is.
Well, even think about how that scene even ends. It ends with violent sex and him basically fucking her into submission to a degree. And it's that release of like, this is what you wanted. And then at the, again, no pun intended, climax, you see that this isn't a happy act anymore. Yeah. It's not an act of love. It's literally an act of aggression.
Shasta has tears in her eyes and rolling down her cheeks.
Well, and also like his face suddenly changes, because it's that moment of epiphany of like, maybe this is how I always viewed her. Maybe I viewed her incorrectly throughout even our time together that I considered so idealized and like my version of like the love of my life. But I also think in terms of the Venn diagram, it's interesting to consider Mickey Wolfman as a character, even though we don't really know him beyond being kind of this walking MacGuffin to a degree that Doc is pursuing throughout the movie. But like you just even mentioned that, you know, Mickey Wolfman farms these girls out that he gets involved with. And again, I am going to bring up Manson a lot in this, but because I believe the entire movie kind of lives in the shadow of Manson. to a degree, but there's no real difference between what Mickey Wolfman did with Farming Girls Out and what, you know, if you ever do any kind of deep dive research into Manson and the family and his harem of women, is like, that's what he would do. He would use his women as bartering chips and as ways to essentially satisfy everyone from, you know, George Spann on the ranch to Dennis Wilson when he basically was trying to infiltrate Hollywood and make a record with Terry Melcher on Cielo Drive. And, you know, and also not to kind of bounce off and disagree with you on something again, but I find your interpretation of Bigfoot and Bigfoot's, let's say,
You're coming from my heart now.
No,
Jacob, are coming from my heart.
Well, I'm just saying that I think the moment when Bigfoot says no Cielo Drive for Bigfoot, no TV rights for Bigfoot, like, yeah, I think that's a moment of like sadness for him, but I think it's more of a comment because Pynchon wrote this book in what, 2006 or so.
I mean, it came out in 2009.
It's like mid-2000s.
I don't, because we don't have a bevy of conversations with the man. I'm not sure what the gestation period for it was and how long it took him to write. Came out in 2009.
He wrote it in the 2000s.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay. It came out in 2009. That's more what I was going for. Is when the book was released. So this is very much a reflection on a time period that he lived through and was lamenting the loss of and perhaps idealizing himself to a degree. But the whole no Cielo Drive for Bigfoot, what I find really interesting about that moment and where I slightly disagree with you too, is that Bigfoot looks at Cielo Drive as like the assignment that he never got, the big case that he never got, because it's just as much Pynchon commenting on the fact that like there were vultures circling around Manson and Cielo Drive and who saw him as basically a meal ticket to a degree, because, you know, once you get into like the backstory of Vince Bugliosi, the district attorney who tried, you know, Manson during the 1970 trial that became like the longest running and most expensive trial in California history. Like, there's the whole idea that, you know, Vince Bugliosi saw Manson as a meal ticket and saw him as a way to basically make a name for himself, which he did by becoming the most lucrative true crime author in history with Helter Skelter. I always wondered how much of Bigfoot lamenting no Cielo Drive for Bigfoot is that it was almost like, well, that I never got my big break. I never got my big case, you know, and like Manson was like, he looks on at it and Cielo Drive and those murders, not with empathy, but with jealousy, because it's almost like, well, those guys over there, they're becoming famous because they just got that assignment. Like, where's Bigfoot's assignment? Bigfoot's done, you know, I'm doing commercials and shit for these estates.
I totally agree with that. I don't disagree with that. I think Bigfoot's a very, and my God, well, it always comes back to Bigfoot in these episodes, even when he's not in them.
He's arguably the best part of the movie.
I would say so.
As you've brought up many times as well, like Brolin, every time he's on screen, just owns every scene that he's in. And then when he's not on screen, you're like, so when's Bigfoot coming back?
But no, I don't disagree with that reading of his relationship to something like Cielo Drive. I got these episodes, they all blur together for me. I think it was with Alicia Malone that I mentioned that I think that for Bigfoot, you know, he's certainly a hypocrite, and he, given his relationship to the law enforcement body that has kind of ruined his life and killed his partner that he's still a part of. And so I do think there are some particularly loathsome things about his personality. And one of them is, I do think he very selfishly views Cielo Drive as a ladder. It could have been his ladder to climb.
Yeah.
But I also think it's also not so much a meal ticket, and maybe, you know, I am blind when it comes to this man. I do love him, so I do think that in that, that even that selfishness, that disgusting selfishness to, you know, to wish for your own Cielo Drive is that, as I said to Alicia, he's like a Shane Black character to me. Although he imagine, and this would be a very plotless film, but imagine a Shane Black movie with a a burned out, broken down detective who never gets the case that redeems him. And I kind of feel like, Bigfoot is a guy who just very selfishly, I'm not saying he's not selfish, but I do think that I think he has that thing that he wants. Now we're going to speak into Manson, we're going to swerve hard into Once Upon a Time in Hollywood territory. I do think that he wants to feel meaningful. And I think he wants to feel useful. I don't know if I would call it that he wants capital R, like redemption. But I do think he wants that case that he can have to be the detective he sees himself as, or the detective he wants to be, but has to watch.
A Renaissance detective. He is a
okay.
Renaissance
I have
detective.
Been referred to more than one time by the LA Times, which is those two fingers pointing in the air. Okay. But no, I do feel like that. I think there's a jealousy on his part that he has to, you know, he has to see Doc being the one that gets to make moves out there. That he can't be the one. That he understands that in this story, Doc gets to be the hero. And I think that there's part of him that he sees himself as the hero cop. But he, as I think we all do in our lives, you know, he sees himself as the hero of the story. And yet his hypocrisies and his cowardice. He acknowledges that that's not who he gets to be, and that's not who he is. And I think that he is like a lot of us, where he's like, if only I had that one thing, I would have been better. If I only had that one thing, then I would have been the guy.
Can I ask you a question about Bigfoot too that might piss you off?
Well, I've already got veins throbbing in my forehead, Jacob, so you go right ahead. Fire away.
Do you think that there's any way that Bigfoot was involved in the murder of his partner? Because I often wonder that, and I often wonder if his actions aren't out of vengeance for grief. Well, they are grief, but perhaps there's more guilt than grief.
You sick son of a bitch, how could you say look how sad, look how he fillets that banana. Would
no,
you do
I,
that?
I agree.
Now, that's a valid question. I have never taken it that way. There's a brief moment in the novel. It's always weird to try to suss out.
Well, and that's the other reason I bring it up, is because I feel like the novel may implicate him to a degree.
Yeah,
I don't know.
The weirdest, have you read the book?
I have.
I'm guessing you've read it. Okay. Yeah, so that's the thing. It's always hard sussing out how much of the novel is, what do you call it, canon? When approaching the film, because the film is so much its own thing.
Sure.
And how much of the backstory do we allow to count from the novel if it's not in the film? And, you know, certainly there's stuff that would totally change the film, like the fact that, you know, Sortilege is conclusively real in the book.
Yeah.
But in as far as the film goes, you know, there is that brief moment where when Doc is finding out that Golden Fang hitters Puck Beaverton and Adrian Prussia had a hand in Bigfoot's partner's death, Vincent
right.
Delicato. And there's that moment where Doc's trying to figure out, well, Jesus Christ, was Bigfoot a part of this? Was there something more going on? Because this whole thing about LAPD cops, you know, and they're kind of unswerving loyalty to each other as partners. That's kind of like the one thing I can give them credit for. And yet I do feel like, you know, and he even says, you know, how come, you know, he basically paints a portrait of Bigfoot as Charles Bronson in 10 to Midnight, just killing everybody around him and asking himself, you know, why didn't Bigfoot do that? What stopped him from doing that? My reading on it is very much that the book makes clear that Bigfoot's partner was a problem. That Bigfoot's partner was someone who was not going to be a part of the more nefarious, Golden Fang-ish type shit that was going down, that was infesting the LAPD. And so that's why he had to get out of it. That's why they had to take him out. I don't think that Doc or excuse me, I don't think Bigfoot had a hand in it, and I don't think he saw it coming. And
I don't know.
I think the difference, I think that Bigfoot's primary failing as a man and a detective and a partner in any sense of the word is that once he realized how serious the thing was and that they would be willing to take out a cop, I think once it got to that point, that's when he made the decision that he was going to, or once the opportunity came with the Wolfman kidnapping, he was going to outsource his vengeance to someone else. He was going to put it in the hands of Doc. And now so that
part I agree with.
Yeah. Go ahead. You say your thing. Everybody knows how I feel.
Well, no. And my thing is that I wanted to tie it back to the scene that we're going to talk about today, is that I wonder how much of it ties into the idea of the Golden Fang's infiltration of the LAPD, and sort of the same way that, you know, the FBI comes in the scene that we see today. And it's the only scene that you see the FBI agents later in the movie, but this is really the only time that they actually open their mouths and speak, you know, to Doc, let's say. Well, not the only time, but you know what I'm saying, is that, yeah, like, this is their big moment, you know? And, like, I always wondered at the end of the scene that we watched today, you know, the one agent looks at Doc and goes, you know, you can make $300 a week working as a COINTELPRO or informant. And I wondered how much or if any of that was offered to Bigfoot as maybe an incentive to work with the Golden Fang when they began to infiltrate the LAPD, is maybe he didn't realize the same way that, say, Doc or any other hippie would realize when they're offered to basically be an informant for the FBI, that it's like, yes, this $300 a week, enticing, but they didn't realize the consequences of actually taking that money. And I wondered in the let's say, this narrative that really doesn't exist in the book or the movie, but I kind of make up in my head, to be fair, is I wondered if, like, when the Golden Fang comes and infiltrates the LAPD, if maybe there was something offered to Bigfoot or to other cops, or, like, to a degree that they don't understand. And his partner dying was unfortunately the negative byproduct of their infiltration. And now he's stuck with both the longing for this man who he obviously loves, to what end, we're not really sure, but it's pretty clear that he wanted to put something in his mouth at one point. But, like,
subtle, Jake.
Well, I'm just saying, he's sucking that banana down, man.
Yeah, but, and I gotta tell you, those don't taste very good. Those bananas. I'm.
You know what? I
bless my guests.
When I listened to that episode, I was really shocked at your displeasure with the chocolate covered banana, because I find the chocolate covered banana to be delicious, and that's not a sexual euphemism.
It's a violent mishmash of taste and texture that is just not for me. I did not like it.
You're a strange guy, man. Chocolate covered banana is very good.
I'm on the host of a goddamn Inherent Vice podcast. there are problems at home. Let's say that.
But no, it's I do very much wonder if perhaps that was the byproduct of that.
Well,
if,
you know, it's not. God, we are really getting to some nerd ass debate here about these fictional characters. I will say, if we are going to cull a little bit from the book, that there is a scene after in the book, after Bigfoot has decided to kick Mr. Sportello, and he drives him to the impound to pick up his car from,
you know,
LA to
him
Woodland
kicking
Hills.
Him, that would be assault, Travis.
You're gonna kick him. Greatest stroke of the goddamn movie. But he's driving Doc out to Woodland Hills from LA to go pick up his car. And in that scene, Bigfoot does try to get Doc to be a paid informant, offers him cash, and he offers you, you know, he's like, look, we've got warehouses of confiscated weed, if that's what you want. So I don't know if, although, and again, we're talking about the book now, which who knows how much of that can be considered in keeping with the film. But in the book, Bigfoot is more than happy to try to entice Doc to become an informant as well, which I don't know that he would do if he was also having this kind of mournful existential crisis about having sold his own soul to a force far larger and more dangerous than he realized. I don't know that he would do it again unless Bigfoot truly is, you know, completely far more morally bereft than I give him credit for. I don't think that he would do that. But, you know, we'll have to have Thomas Pynchon on and, you know, ask him directly, I guess, because, you know, I could see it, as you said, where he does initially work with the thing kind of in the way that Coy Harlingen did, where, you know, he says, look, you know, me and my wife, we were on heroin. The baby looked like hell. I wasn't doing my family any good at home. I thought maybe I could do some good here. And it's only after I signed on that I realized this is just a gang. And it's all about just keeping us in line. And perhaps there very well could have been something like that similar with Bigfoot, where, you know, he is a 1950s law and order man. And this is an organization that very much seems to fit into that monochrome 1955 vision of the world. And it could probably initially be appealing before realizing how truly dark and selfish and evil their ends are.
Well, like the Fang, you refer to it as a gang, and it is referred to as sort of a gang in the movie as well. But like, that's the CIA, right? Like, that's how I always interpret. Well, that's how I always interpreted the Golden Fang, is not an operation or like a drug cartel. I always interpreted it as being, you know, an extension of the CIA. And well,
CIA was a drug cartel.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, they're like an extension of their work in Vietnam and Indochina and Air America and things like that. To where, like, and it's kind of one of the things that I did want to bring up as we talk more and more about this, is that, you know, one of the things I did to prepare for this podcast is I revisited one of my favorite books from the last year or so, a book called Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA and the Secret History of the 60s by this guy named Tom O'Neill, which basically chronicles 20 years of research into the Manson case and how this guy basically became obsessed with the idea of not only, you know, Vince Bugliosi basically being kind of the big bad and orchestrating the trial to a degree so that its narrative basically fit the narrative that the LA County sheriffs and the DA wanted, but also the idea that like the CIA had infiltrated the LA County sheriffs and the LAPD to a degree that they were basically pulling the strings, and that Manson could very well have been. And granted, this is when you start to spill into really crazy ass fucking conspiracy theory levels. But like that Manson could have acted as an agent for either the CIA's Chaos program or the FBI's COINTEL program to kind of infiltrate the counterculture that the way that they had been doing since the late 50s with like the you know, the Red Scare, the Communist Scare. I believe COINTELPRO was established in like 1957 or 58. And that was like their original goal was to smash quote unquote communism, which was all bullshit anyway. But like, and then it basically evolved into essentially disrupting any sort of
any
political
subversive group.
Yeah, basically any subversive point group, any political group that J. Edgar Hoover or the CIA saw as a direct threat to the status quo, you know, things like the student movement out in Berkeley, the Black Panthers. That's what I always found interesting, is reading this book and kind of like listening to your podcast and everything, and then watching the movie, is how much of this kind of bled into my interpretation of the movie itself is because I saw it and I was like, well, no, the Fang is, you know, that's the CIA. Like, that's what we're talking about here.
And sure. And I will say, if you could ever have a double feature of a film with a book, you could do a lot worse than Inherent Vice and Chaos, because it's not so much of a spoiler, but, you know, a big part of the book Chaos posits that the all of Helter Skelter as a motivation for the Tate LaBianca murders was horseshit, that it was done. It was orchestrated by Manson and his family to, there was a Manson family member named Bobby Beausoleil who got arrested for killing a guy. And
yeah, Gary Hinman.
Yeah, he killed Gary Beausoleil and two of the family girls killed Gary Hinman. They got arrested for it. And in a panic, Beausoleil called Manson and said, you got to go put a sign out there in the world, make it look like this killing is still happening. So they'll think the real killer is still out there. They'll let me go. There's a lot of people that believe that was the actual motivation for all the handwriting, political piggy, the blood writing on the walls and things like that at the Tate LaBianca murders, was to basically say, oh, no, it wasn't Beausoleil. It was these other people. They're still out there somewhere. You got the wrong guy. Let him go. The point of that is, you know, the author of the book goes through all these different permutations, as you said, you know, maybe Manson is part of this anti-subversive group. Maybe he's working for the government. Whatever the case may be, the author firmly believes that Helter Skelter was not the motivation for those killings. And essentially, the book ends with this very kind of diffuse confusion in which the author more or less says, look, I don't have an answer. I don't have a grand unifying answer for any of this. I just know that what we've been told is the answer isn't the truth.
Right.
And I meeting Manson. Yeah, and I very much feel like that could be the cultural or political ethos of both Inherent Vice, the book, and the film, which is that, look, what this means, that's kind of up to you. I mean, look, I mean, I'm obviously it's up in the air. I'm making a podcast about what the hell this could possibly mean, because there is no definitive answer, and that's the only thing we can know, is that there is no answer. And I think that there really is no ultimate answer about Inherent Vice, just like there may be no ultimate answer about why those horrible, ghoulish killings happened. We just know that they did. And all we can really know is that we don't know why. And I feel like, so yeah, if you want to get real pretentious with it, Chaos would be a good book to read both before or after watching Inherent Vice. They do go well together in that very hazy, lazy. Go ahead.
I was going to say, let me tell you, I got real pretentious with it.
Well, hey, you are in the right goddamn place. If you want to get pretentious with it, this is the place to do it. One last pretentious thing I'm going to say before we should probably jump into this scene proper and actually talk about this film. You know, it's interesting that we're talking about COINTELPRO informants, and we're talking about LAPD informants, and we're talking about Doc's vision of himself as maybe being a little bit closer on the shithead Venn diagram vis-a-vis his relationship with Shasta than he actually thought he was. Maybe a little closer to Wolfman than maybe he realized. I think that this is a really interesting scene to talk about that, because this is one of those moments, as you said, where you can see how easy it is to slip into the other side, the other political or philosophical side, because they will make it more comfortable for you. $300 extra a week, that's not a bad deal.
There
is a slippery slope of just wanting to be comfortable and not doing it because you want to be evil and not sitting there. You know, not everyone is Rudy Blatnoid, DDS, you know, kind of nefariously involved for sheer hedonism's sake. Or not everybody is a morally vacant, to steal Jim Hemphill's phrase from the last episode, Crocker Fenway. You know, a lot of times it's just this hazily interlinked lattice of beneficiaries. You know, that's how it happens. That's how some of these groups can pull you in. You're just a coy harlingen, just trying to straighten up your life and figure yourself out and get off smack and keep your daughter alive and pay to keep the roof over her head. So, yeah, you just decide to join this kind of conservative Republican group. And before you know it, you're part of, you know, this philosophical organization that's kind of destroying the world. And I feel like there is a lot of that in this scene where you see how easy it would be. And bless his heart, Doc doesn't do it. And I love Doc for that. But you see how easily he could make his life if he just kind of went along with it. If he just says, sure, I'm a professional snoop anyway. So I always notice things and not everything is privileged. If I pick something up, if I, you know, I put a cup to a wall and I overhear something on the other side you might find interesting. Yeah, I can let you know. It's all you're asking for. You're not asking for much. And I think that's something that this scene really shows. And I think that's something that connects with what you said about the sex scene and about how easy it is to slip into being not the good guy.
Yeah. And also, like, to bring it back to Bigfoot as well and how he was basically pulling the strings the entire time, like, it again made me think about just how you can reinterpret, and you've brought this up on previous episodes as well, is that, like, you first watched the movie, and I did this too when I first saw it at Bonumathon, is that you watch the movie and you're like, man, this guy's, like, real goofy. He's kind of, like... Is he helping Doc out? Are they friends? Like, even though he has this obvious antagonistic relationship with not only Doc but hippies in general, mm-hmm. But then you kind of revisit it and you sit there and you go, oh no, he's pulling the strings. Like, he's pushing Doc towards an answer. And to bring it kind of back to Chaos, there's a passage in Chaos where I started thinking about Bigfoot, and again, it kind of pushed me to think about Bigfoot differently, is that Tom O'Neill goes into a particular police detective named William Herman, who worked in the LAPD, and that he was perhaps became a Chaos or counterintelligence agent as well, and collaborated with but this passage in particular just made me think of the whole Renaissance detective thing, to where he says, a longtime lieutenant with the LAPD, Herman had an unusual background for law enforcement. He had a doctorate in psychology. He specialized in quelling insurgencies. He developed one of the first computer systems to track criminals and predict violent outbreaks in cities. Daryl Gates, the head of the LAPD from 1978 to 1992, hailed him as a genius. A Renaissance detective, that is me, but praising his technical aptitude in particular. And just reading that passage again just made me think of Bigfoot. Now, obviously, William Herman, I don't think Bigfoot held a doctorate. He certainly didn't design a computer. And, like, it actually goes into his background even deeper, is that he, you know, spent quite a few times overseas, probably working within the Project Phoenix program, training guerrillas and counterintelligence insurgents in Vietnam. So, like, I don't think Bigfoot did any of that, but it just was another thing to consider as I basically watched this movie and was like, you can almost draw parallels between these people from actual history and these fictional caricatures that Pynchon was drawing and PTA adapts for the big screen.
Wow. You've got me looking at the Bigfoot like he's almost like David Ferry or something at this point.
Jeez. He's not quite David Ferry, but I think he's more, I do believe he's more sinister than you do, I think. Like, I find him to be very menacing for a lot. He's hilarious. Every time he enters the movie again, like, you're like, thank God Bigfoot's back. It's this is going to be great. But also I interpret the whole scene where he breaks down the door at the end and, like, eats the weed in the most ridiculous moment of the whole movie. I think I interpret that slightly different from you as well, because it's just this final act of, like, frustration and maybe he's not trying to empathize with Doc as much as he's just finally consuming what he sees to be, like, Doc's soul as a means to basically push forward and maybe finally break out of his kind of static existence within the LAPD.
It's entirely possible. I don't know that I buy it, but it's entirely, as with all things inherent vice, it is entirely possible. All I know is there's no official answer, just like in chaos. I agree. Bigfoot is kind of an ominous figure. I think, you know, there is something a little nerve-wracking about him. There is something a little scary about him. Does he want to, like, absorb Doc's soul? I probably wouldn't go that far. I would say I would probably stick to the supposition. I think he wants to be Doc. I think he wants to be the hero. But I do think he, as I said many times before, he does have that very kind of Ralph Meeker vibe where you like him, you like watching him, but you'd probably be scared shitless if you were riding alongside with him in his car. What, even if he's not blowing a banana, there's just something about him that feels, you know, like the Godfather, just feels a little dangerous. You don't want to be right next to him, especially when he might blow. No pun intended.
He also strangely reminds me of a James Ellroy character at times. And I think about him a lot the same way that I think about Russell Crowe in L.A. Confidential, is that he's just this, like, beefy...
He's a force of rage.
Yeah, he's just this beefy lug of a human being who's going to beat down any door that's that's in his way. Brolin, of course, much funnier than Russell Crowe in that movie. But, I mean, Russell Crowe's character in that movie, quite tragic. But, you know, that's also how I view Bigfoot, too, is just this connection to that hardened L.A. noir detective who... you know, is this almost paragon of masculinity to a certain degree.
Yeah, totally, totally. And like Doc says in this very scene, he's real intelligent about this kind of shit.
Yeah.
And speaking of which, let's say you and I actually watch the scene that we're supposed to be talking about and come back and actually talk about it. What a novel concept. You want to give that a try?
Sure. I feel like we have been talking about it, though. It's just, you know,
we haven't had the actual. Yeah, so we're going to do that. We'll be right back and we'll continue to talk about this scene. Back now.
I'm Agent Flatley. This is Agent Borderline, FBI.
I just had to use the bathroom.
It's been brought to our attention that not too long ago you had a visit from a black prison militant calling himself Tariq Khalil. We naturally became curious.
Let's talk upstairs, Larry.
Did I miss an episode? I love you guys every Sunday night, 8 p.m.
We like investigating and spending energy on black nationalist hate groups.
It's the chronology, really. Khalil visits your place of business. The next day, a known prison acquaintance of his, Glenn Charlock, is slain. Michael Wolfman disappears, and you get arrested on suspicion and somewhat mysteriously let go again.
Yeah. Well, have you talked to Bigfoot Bjornsson about all this? Because he's real intelligent about this kind of shit.
Mr. Bjornsson's antipathy at the federal level is well known.
Some guys are like that. Mm. So, what is it you want with me?
Ordinarily, we're the ones asking the questions here.
No, sure thing, fellas, but aren't we all in the same business?
There's no need to be insulting.
Why don't you just go ahead and tell us what Mr. Khalil had to say when he visited you the other day?
Because he's privileged and I'm a client is why.
If it has a bearing on the Wolfman case, then we may have to disagree.
Look, I really wish I could help you guys out, but what I can't figure is if you're so focused on the Black Panthers, then what's with your interest in Mickey Wolfman? Was somebody playing Monopoly with federal housing money? You figure Mickey's kidnapping is a Black Panther operation? They put the snatch on Mickey trying to prove a political point, or maybe a nice shot at some ransom money? Maybe you've at least thought of putting that forward as a cover story for whatever did happen.
Do you realize how thoroughly we can fuck your life up?
Mm-hmm. All right. Could I be frank a minute?
Why stop now?
Please.
You be Dino, you be the other guy, and tell Penny Davis Jr. what a lovely day we had. Thank you.
As a COINTELPRO informant, you could be making up to $300 a month, Larry. Just consider that.
US dollars?
And we'll throw in a Book of Mormon. Free.
And we're back. And I know you're chomping at the bit. You've got something you want to hit. So you hit it.
Well, again, when I watch this scene, it makes me remember that in my head, Paul Thomas Anderson is making two types of movies at the mm-hmm. same time, is that he is very much making this humanistic film about the ways that we deal with loss, the inherent vice of time, as you've kind of quoted Joan Didion again and again on the show. However, this is also the moment where he's exploring the political aspects or the political implications of the book, because, you know, as much as this is a roadblock in Doc's mystery and he's basically trying to talk his way around them to a certain degree, mm-hmm. It makes me think of a quote that occurs in the movie, too, in its Sora Leach's narration, to where she asks, was it possible that at every gathering, concert, peace rally, love-in, be-in, freaking, here up north, back east, wherever, some dark crews had been busy all along reclaiming the music, the resistance to power, the sexual desire to effort to every day. All they could sweep up for the ancient forces of greed and fear. Gee, he thought, I don't know. Because what this makes me think of is how not only, you know, forces like Manson or like, neo-Nazi bikers, let's say, might be infiltrating the peace and love movement, but also our own government and our own intelligence agencies like the FBI and their COINTELPRO or programs, or the CIA and the Chaos program were infiltrating, you know, the hippie movement or attempting to infiltrate the hippie movement and basically take control and disrupt it to a degree. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what this scene is showing you, is because have you ever, not to kind of bring it back to, let's say, another pretentious level, but let's have do you it. Ever have you ever heard of the term hysterical realism?
Yeah.
Okay, so you know what I'm about to say. And for those listening at home, hysterical realism was a categorization of literature. It was coined, it was a term that was kind of coined in the early 2000s, I believe actually the year 2000, in the New Republic, by this English critic named James Wood. He was writing an essay on Zadie Smith's White Teeth. And basically what Wood was talking about was with hysterical realism, was that he's basically describing the great American novel, what we yeah. have in a very cliched sense come to term the great American novel. And he says he calls it the big ambitious novel that knows a thousand things, but does not know a single human being. And the types of books that he's lumping White Teeth in with are stuff like David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, Don DeLillo's Underworld, and Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow.
Perpetual motion machines. That's what he called them, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I believe to a degree that Paul Thomas Anderson is making a hysterically realist movie here. And that scenes like this with these FBI agents are just as much exploring notions and ideas and how these people aren't so much human beings as they are avatars for things that were occurring within this particular decade and American history in general. And I think if you kind of come at the movie from that sideways angle, you can extract a decent amount more of meaning than if you were to just kind of look at it as a mystery or this movie about relationships or whatever. Like, he's just as much commenting on the evolution of American history and how Doc is becoming, let's say, quote unquote, woke to the idea that, hey, the decade that he idealizes and loves and lived through and kind of still pines for might have been the entire time tainted with a true evil from both, the government and forces beyond his control.
Yeah, that I totally agree with you there. And I especially having read the Pynchon book, which is so much more bitter and I think so much more politically driven and philosophically driven, there's very much that end of Easy Rider mood of we blew it. That, you know, we were part of the problem too. We were all part of the problem. It wasn't just this kind of airily defined bad guy. It was all of us, and we let this fail and we brought it down. Is that what you mean?
Or
not at all.
Sort of. You're on the right track, but I think it's more realizing your own naivete about things that you love. And the fact that, hey, you know what? Maybe we weren't all in love together. Maybe there were things that were trying to manipulate us the entire time and infiltrate these. And like, because, you know, that's even part of like what you deal with Mickey Wolfman and him giving all his money away as being like, maybe I was a force for bad, you know, for evil. Maybe I was contributing to basically the poisoning of a generation myself, you know? And it's, that's what I find really interesting about this movie is because like, this isn't the first time that Paul Thomas Anderson has done this in his career. To me, the closest cousin that you have to Inherent Vice, and you know, a lot of people say The Master, and I agree with that in terms of just a construction or visual sense. But to me, the movie that this reminds me the most of, at least in ethos, is Punch Drunk Love, because in how I believe PTA is trying to make one movie. Like, and with Punch Drunk Love, like he enters into Punch Drunk Love basically being like, I want to make an Adam Sandler movie. And he even admits that you've listened to the, I don't even know why I asked this question because there's no doubt that you've listened to this, but his Marc Maron interview.
I have, yeah. It's where we get the line. It's about love, baby.
Yeah, exactly. So like, you know, he talks about wanting to make an Adam Sandler movie there with Punch Drunk Love and how, like, you know, if you were to give him, you know, 10 movies to choose, you know, he's always going to sit there and choose the Adam Sandler film. He's going to watch the Happy Gilmore. He's going to watch the Billy Madison. I mean, he even cites Big Daddy as being the movie that inspired him to want to work with Adam Sandler, is that he's basically he's like, hey man, I'm going to watch the movie that makes me feel good over the one that, you know, I have to engage with on any kind of deep emotional or intellectual level. It's not a bad thing. It's just like, that's just the movie I want to watch. And that's the movie he quote unquote wanted to make with Punch Drunk Love, which he sort of did. Like, he sort of makes an Adam Sandler movie with that, but at the same time he abstracts the idea to such a degree that it almost becomes impenetrable at certain times. And I think he does the same thing with Inherent Vice, in that he wants to make this movie about relationships, and he wants to make this movie about loss, and he wants to make this movie about what are the things that you can't live without, that time takes away from you. And he does. He succeeds in doing that. But at the same time, he's also abstracting the idea of the L.A. noir and the L.A. mystery, to where, like, the mystery here matters, but it doesn't matter in the way that, like, solving it, who cares by the end? What it really is about is Doc having his eyes open to both his own role that he played in his relationship with Shasta, as well as perhaps the role that the hippie movement was manipulated to play because of, you know, forces like the Golden Fang, or in my interpretation, the CIA, COINTELPRO, things of that nature, and how, like, Manson infiltrated it, and we saw the dark side of the hippie movement, and everything was basically poisoned. It was the idea that, like, here at the end, the solution to the mystery is, man, shit might have been more fucked up than I ever gave it credit for. And I'm really fascinated by that idea.
Yeah, you know, I don't think you're wrong, and I think that you can look at this scene really easily, in fact, as a kind of, I don't even know if this is a word, an epiphanal moment for Doc when, you know, they're interrogating these two feds, agents Borderline and Flatweed, are they're bracing Doc.
What names, by the way?
Yeah, it's Pynchon, man. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah, exactly.
He seems to know, he's a pretty good writer. He's all right. He seems like he knows what he's doing. But when they're bracing him and they're talking about, you know, we know that you spoke to a militant black nationalist yesterday, and now today we've got a dead body of his enemy from prison. What is this? And how quickly Doc is able to kind of use that doper's ESP to be like, well, what the hell what does this got to do with Mickey Wolf, man? And he's, you know, what's he say? You know, if you're so focused on the Black Panthers, then what is your interest in Wolfman? Is somebody, and he just kind of starts, you see the way his mind works as and you realize what a good detective he actually is.
Yeah.
When he's like, is somebody playing Monopoly money with federal housing? He's like, no, that can't be it. Or do you think it's the Wolfman kidnapping? It's Black Panther operation. They put the snatch on Mickey. And then he's like, no, wait. Is that just something you're thinking of putting forward as the cover story for what really did happen? And that, to me, is where you realize how sharp Doc is. And you can tie it back to that, to Chaos, where you basically have an author looking at the Manson murders going, well, could it have been this? No. Could it have been that? No, not really. It's just, I don't know what it is, but it's got to be, it's all a cover for what really happened. And that's not what I'm not going to be able to find out what that was. I just know that this is a lie. And I feel like you're right in that this does seem like a moment where Doc's kind of looking around. He's looking at the politics of his day. He's looking at his generation and realizing how much of this might have been a scam or a story sold to them by these positions of power.
You know, what's the other thing that this reminds me of? This scene and the movie in particular, have you read any of Don Winslow's Cartel novels?
I have. I'm a big fan of Don.
Okay. So, like, particularly Power of the Dog, in which this is very much like the thing that I love about Power of the Dog, and it's really what hooked me into his novels, is because, like I like The Force. I like The Winter of Frankie Machine, but those are almost just straight ahead pulp works.
Yeah.
You know, he's writing cop books, he's writing hitman books, mafia stuff. Like, it's all very simple. And that's no offense to Don Winslow, he's very fucking good at what he does. Yeah,
they're great,
but
they're,
like,
they are great pulp.
They're great, great, great pulp. But Power of the Dog combines that with an almost like alternative history lesson, let's say, to where you learn about how the cartels were essentially put into place in Mexico and South America and everything, and how that extends to the CIA, their work in Vietnam, Air America, and how we those forces kind of conspired along with them, sometimes against their own will, and ended up installing this very nefarious, horrible, deadly institution that continues to basically poison the world to this day. It reminds me of that, and to where, again, you have Art Keller, in those books, the central CIA agent who basically has his eyes open to the idea throughout these books. Well, really throughout the first book, and then the rest of the next two books, The Cartel and The Border, it's really about his battle against these people because of what happened. But he has his eyes opened to this, like, holy shit, we were sold a lie the whole time. And I was even complicit and even helped push that lie forward. And I always find that those books to be interesting, let's say, companion pieces to interpreting Inherent Vice, or like reading something like Chaos or something, is that alternative history of America is always going to fascinate me, because I am almost innately a very paranoid, questioning person. Never quite to like conspiracy theory levels. That is the one thing that I like about Tom O'Neill's book, is that he very much walks you through like his thought process, and is even like, you know, I realize that I'm bordering on like total nut job lunacy at certain points. But I love these stories about how these individuals having their eyes opened up to maybe the lies that they've been told the entire time, because, and you've said this on the show many times, is that you watch TV nowadays, especially with the fucking morons that we deal with on a governmental level. Now is that you just watch it and you're just like this whole impeachment thing that's going on, not to get too political, but like, how much of this is a sham? How much of this is fucking meaningless? And it's just all a dog and pony show that's really going to amount to nothing. Trump's going to walk away. No punishment is ever going to be implemented. And the damage to America has been done. And we're only really going to start uncovering how deep that sort of corruption and horrible influence and insidious poison that, you know, this administration has kind of injected into America and the global, let's say, ecosphere as well, 20 years from now. You know, right now we're just experiencing it. You only get to uncover history in hindsight for the most part.
Oh God, exactly. And boy, you and Jim Hempel, my last guest, you guys would be a barrel of monkeys to go to a bar with him saying that we're all going to end up in a Mad Max post-nuclear warlord zone in a couple of years.
I don't think we're ever going to get to that point. My worldview is much bleaker, as I just am waiting for that day where I look over the horizon and see the mushroom cloud and be like, all right, guys, well, it was great. We're all dead now.
You know, my next guest better be super positive. This is two in a row now foretelling doom, foretelling, you know, nuclear winter and doom. We're not going to go down that road, because I'm going to get all depressed and sad at the end of this episode. But I do think that you're right. And I do think that I think definitely a big fundamental part of this story, book or film, is about not realizing the level of damage done until you kind of hang back and look around and assess. And it takes time to do that. And I think that that's so much of what especially the novel was, you know, the novel being so much of a hangover book to the way this is a hangover movie, but a hangover book for a decade, and beginning to look back at the 60s. And again, you know, to bring it back to Captain America and Easy Rider, going, oh, wow, we blew it. But not, we didn't blow it at the end. It was blown from the beginning. We never had a shot. The damage had already been done. The wrong people had always been in power. We were never going to make a difference.
How complicit were you the entire time?
Which brings it back to, as you said, at the beginning of this episode, when Doc begins to wonder how different, you know, I do believe Doc is a good man. I don't think that Doc is villain.
Yeah.
But there is
good people have, but that's what makes you a good person, right?
The willingness to contemplate. And be horrified by that contemplation and what you find there.
A certain level of inventory and say, like, I fucked up here.
Exactly. And I can see then why, with that mindset, you might even doubt my beloved Bigfoot for a moment and wonder what he might have had to do with the death of his partner. There is, I think, that is definitely, I think, a strain in the film and the book, where it's people looking around going, what part did I play in this? You know, I feel like I'm a good guy. I feel like I'm the hero of my story, but what did I do? What did I not do? What, you know, was it, you know, I think it's also, I think, very, very pertinent that we never really find out why Shasta was driven away. It's never really explicated. And Doc seems clueless and has absolutely no understanding why she might have wanted to leave him. And I'm not saying that he did anything nefarious, but I think it's something, I think, to do with that inability to truly see that what went wrong was actually going wrong way before you ever realized that there was a fissure or a crack or a damage in the firmament. That Shasta's reasons for leaving probably existed long before Doc even began to realize the relationship was ending. Just like, you know, as we sit here now, looking at the pageantry on the news every day, the horrifying pageantry on the news every day, probably not thinking, not realizing how far back the seeds of this current madness were placed. And we'd probably be shocked if we really were able to find out how far back it goes to where it first became inevitable, how long ago it probably was.
Yeah.
And I gotta say, dark as that is, and a gloomy mood you've put me in now, Jacob, you did exactly what I hoped you would do, which is, I knew in having you come on, you were going to get me to look at this scene in a way that I hadn't looked at it before. I it's not that I disliked this scene. In a film of which I am completely and obviously obsessed, this just happened to be the lone sequence that I would watch and go, yeah, I have nothing really to say about this. It's pretty obvious. The FBI, they're in on the Wolfman snatch, and they're just creating a cover story for it. What am I supposed to say about that? It's a bit of plot that gets me to the next scene. But I now see it as being something that is rather politically and philosophically rich and is going to send me now off into the night feeling really depressed about my nation's future. So I'm glad that I was. I thank you for that.
Yeah, man. I'm glad I was here to help just ruin your day.
you have happily ruined my day and spoiled this wonderful film for me, destroyed my viewpoint of Bigfoot Bjornsson. You have totally deconstructed me and disassembled me as a human being. But you
somehow
know what?
I doubt that.
Yeah, I'll be back next week talking about what a quiet hero at heart Bigfoot wants to be. But I appreciate your viewpoint. I appreciate you bringing this viewpoint to me. This is one of the best, most enjoyable parts of the show for me is just seeing how easily filtered this film is through other people's minds, and how everyone, this film is so strangely constructed that you kind of like in Chaos, you can bring almost any theory to this and it'll hold a little bit of water and it will make a little bit of sense. You might not be for sure that it's the right answer, but you know, it's a better answer than what we were given. And that's what's so great about talking about this film with people, especially you. And as I said, you've really kind of saved this scene for me. You've given me something to toy with now. Now I have a reason to live again. I have a reason to live again, Jacob. Thank you.
Well, all right.
On that note, we should probably wrap this up. But before we do, tell people where they can find your stuff.
I am on Twitter at Jacob Hugh Knight. And right now I mostly write for rebellermedia.com, where you can catch me every Friday, you know, either doing my original Outlaws column, where I basically kind of run down the history of exploitation cinema, or the alternating or alternating Fridays where I talk about, well, really anything. This week, I think I have coming up, I have a retrospective on Don Johnson and how I think he's one of our great subversive movie stars in a way. So look for that.
Please tell me you write about The Hot Spot.
No.
Oh.
I don't particularly like The Hot Spot. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't. It's a little overcooked for me. Oh. I do talk about the vastly underrated Dead Bang from John Frankenheimer. Yes, exactly. One of the great 80s action movies that I think is one of the great subversive 80s action movies of all time. It is kind of one of the keys to unlocking Johnson's appeal as an undercover subversive movie star. So I think you'll enjoy it.
You know, I gotta say, this conversation about Don Johnson has been this episode in Microcosm. You break my heart a little bit at the top, and then you win me back at the end. You bring me back in the end, and you give me something.
Well, like I said at the beginning, I've never lived up to anybody's expectations, but I'll tell you what, it's entertaining to watch me try.
It is. And you know what? I've loved having you on today. Anybody out there, go read Jacob's stuff. I find him to be one of the most entertaining and insightful film writers out there. I always come away with something new, just like I have today. I always come away with something new and a different way of looking at a film, whether I've seen it a million times or I've seen it never. He always gives me something to work with when I read his work, and it's truly incredible. So everyone, go read Jacob. Jacob, you go relax. I appreciate you coming on today. Thanks for talking to me about this wacky little movie. And I'll be back next time with some dark and lonely work, but somebody's going to do it, right?
And it's got to be you. Thanks for having me on. This has been great.
In his book, Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s, Tom O'Neill posits that for all the hazy strands of paranoid plotting and salacious suspicions and possible reasons behind the Manson family murders, he really can't be sure which, if any, of them are really true, except for the official version, which can only be a lie. And so, what's it mean if we buy into the official version of a story, one that we see, in retrospect, was always a lie? What's it mean to sacrifice just a little bit of soul for a whole lot of comfort? Gee, our host thinks. By the end of Inherent Vice, Doc, sadly, probably knows the answer to that. Will that knowledge save our wayward PI, or push him even further into the fog surrounding the Fang? We'll see what we can see next time on Increment Vice.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.